Whether or not you think of yourself as fashionable, every time you get dressed or go shopping, you're making a choice, and that choice says something about how you see yourself and your social role. My guest Richard Martin is the co-author of Jocks and Nerds, A Visual History of Men's Style in the 20th Century, and an analysis of the cultural trends that inspired those looks. He writes about the styles that borrowed from athletes, intellectuals, cowboys, military men, businessmen, dandies, rebels, and workers. His previous book, Fashion and Surrealism, chronicled the influence of the art movement on designers. Both Jocks and Nerds and Fashion and Surrealism were also shows curated by Martin at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, where he's the dean of graduate studies. Martin is also a former editor of Arts Magazine. Welcome to Fresh Air. As an art historian, how do you think you're looking at fashion differently from, say, people in the fashion world?
I think from a very different kind of perhaps objective point of view, although it certainly has its own biases to it, I think it's really being able to look at fashion in a kind of analytical way. After all, fashion has certain ways of being seen. We all participate in fashion to some degree. We wear clothing. We make decisions about it every day. There must be some way of looking at those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Jocks and Nerds, is about men's style in the 20th century, and I think it's fair to say that the biggest change in men's style of the 20th century is that there's different styles. I mean, it's gone beyond, like, one uniform for everybody.
I think you're right. I think that there is a multiplicity of styles and that men make very deliberate choices about style, not in a way which says, oh, I'm going to wear one particular item or another, but that really is determined by certain kinds of social choices. If you can think about men that you know who get really fixed upon a garment, certain men will have a bomber jacket that they have attached romance to, and the romance of wearing that jacket becomes something evocative every time they put it on, something heroic, just about going to the market, or the guy who's wearing the bush jacket, something that looks as if he's going off to expedition in Africa, even if he's only doing the shopping. We can have a tremendous romantic attachment, a sense of aspiration about clothing. Men very often like to imagine that it's women who fantasize through clothing. I would argue it's just the opposite, that women can create roles through clothing, but that men really create their magic through clothing. And this applies to those men who are dressing in a conservative way, in which they know that they're going to wear the right kind of gray suit in order to succeed at business, or it can be the man who is wearing the same outfit he wore 20 years ago when he was 21 years old.
Why is that happening now? I mean, I don't think you could say that was so true earlier in the 20th century.
I think because of a remarkable stability about men's clothing, that in fact men can continue to buy almost the same garment over a long period of time. That if you want to dress as Joe College, it's now a very stable role. Some aspects of it will change, but you can still find your Basswegians, you can still find your chinos, there's always a rumpled tweed jacket, there's always some kind of cardigan sweater you can throw on. Not so different than what men were wearing in the 1930s, or the kind of Joe College image we have even from the movies, from Jimmy Stewart in the 1930s.
I think one of the interesting changes in men's fashion and in ads for men's fashion is men's underwear. And it's only in the past decade or two that we've seen these, like designer briefs. Like there's always been almost a fetish about women's underwear, and men always wore baggy jockey shorts or BVDs. Why do you think that change is happening? The kind of in a way, it's a visual sexualizing of men in fashion and in advertising.
I think very much so. In the same way in which we're able to look at gender in the last decade in a very different way than we've looked at before. I think we're doing it in academic terms, we're doing it in social terms, and perhaps those are the real generative ones. But what is really happening is that we're able to look at men, able to say that we've always said that men are the spectators and women are the object of what one is looking at. But it can also work the other way. Men can be looked at too. That's what's happened in terms of fashion advertising. For a long period of time, certainly since the Second World War, the primary purchaser of men's undergarments has been women. They buy them as gifts for men. It makes it very logical, then, that women delight in the kind of advertising that shows a handsome, attractive man in the underwear. And, of course, in fact, men, if they could express themselves, might even find that attractive as too, at least as a kind of role model.
Well, you know, there's always been a lot of gay men in the fashion industry, and I wonder if, since so many gay men have come out of the closet, if that's influenced the vision of men in the fashion world now, the way men are displayed in a more sexual way in fashion.
I think that may be a factor, but I think of it really as a somewhat larger issue. When you think that in many of the sports that we have, much more of the body is revealed than it was for men or women 20 or 30 years ago, that now we have a kind of body awareness for men. The most macho man may be going to a gym, and a gym that may have mirrors around. It's not that it's really there for vanity, at least we say that, but really that idea of judging oneself against some kind of model of a perfect male.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is art historian Richard Martin, who writes about fashion and fashion history, and his latest book is called Jocks and Nerds. Now, speaking of jocks, you write about the influence of sports on fashion, and this, perhaps more than any other time, at least in the 20th century, is a time when athletes are having an incredible influence on how men and women dress. What are some of the examples of that that you'd cite now?
I think when you see people wearing those cotton mesh shirts out on the street that you know come directly off of the football field, and that one of the things that's happened in sports in the last decade or so is that a great many of them have had advances in the technology of clothing, and that technology of clothing transfers immediately to the street, and it transfers in some cases to kids, to messengers who are running around, but then it transfers very rapidly to the entire population. It's not entirely a new phenomenon, though. We know that when René Lacoste developed in the 1920s and 1930s a tennis shirt that was comfortable, fitted to the canon of the white garments worn on the tennis court, but allowed a little bit more freedom and allowed as well the garment to absorb some of the moisture from the body. This was really a great technological advance, which we think of as the Lacoste shirt even today. And the polo players use it, so the polo or tennis shirts have really been a staple, particularly of men's wardrobes for more than 50 years now. And a great deal of what we think of as street clothing or leisure clothing in the latter part of the 20th century has its genesis in having been worn for sports.
Sneakers. I remember when I was growing up, you bought sneakers, and now there's so many different hip kinds of sneakers to wear, and depending on where you live and who you are, you have to have the right kind. Do you know anything about the history of the sneaker?
Oh, again, it's really a very interesting history, which I can't cite entirely for you, but it really relates to the history of vulcanized rubber, and I think it's the U.S. Ked Company in the 1920s, again, that was doing great experiments. But it's very true what you say about the wearing of sneakers. When I was a child, you had sneakers at school or you wore them for gym class, and all the rest of the time you had to wear hard-soled shoes. It's hard for me now to imagine that if you see a bunch of kids, almost everybody's wearing sneakers. And not only the kids, then a lot of adults too are discovering that they're a wonderful way of dressing. And that's come to us in part through jogging, but I think through the whole sports and fitness awareness that we've had in the 1970s and 1980s.
Now, you write about the nerd look. What would you describe as the nerd look?
I think the quintessential nerd, as one thinks about it, is someone who's wearing high-water pants. The pants aren't quite long enough. They're hiked up very high on the waist. It's wearing a short-sleeve shirt, but probably a sweater or some kind of sweater vest, with the sense of real disparity that the forearms are exposed, but the body is all covered up, as if it's too hot on the torso and a little bit chilly around the edges, a sense of real physical discomfort. And perhaps with that would go thick glasses as well, and particularly thick dark rims, as if to accentuate the slight discomfort and alienation of the nerd.
Do you think that the nerd look has become almost hip in the past few years?
I think that certainly is true. What had been a disparaged figure in the 1950s really became, and largely I think through rock music, a figure who could be a real model by the 1980s. I think one first saw it through figures in music, a kind of slightly adverse downtown style where it seemed very hip to be a little bit outrageous as a nerd. And then ultimately it's come back to being a quite acceptable style. I think going along with that is really the sense that the nerd represents not only the arts, but also science and technology. Science and technology, which in a traditional interpretation 20, 30 years ago, might have seemed to be alien. Now we embrace it. We embrace it in terms of PCs. We embrace it in terms of knowing perhaps more about technology and user-friendly technology. In that transformation, the nerd who has known about computers, perhaps since Alfred E. Newman, now becomes essential information for all of us, and it may well be that that nerd that we disparaged back in high school is going to be our employer.
You credit Pee Wee Herman as helping to bring the look in, and you mentioned other people in television and in movies who have inspired certain fashion changes. One that I really hadn't thought of is Humphrey Bogart as being responsible for making the trench coat fashionable.
Yes, that great scene, particularly in Casablanca, of wearing of the trench coat. And that's a good case of how there's been such an odyssey, really, of how a male garment has gone from its first use, which was as a military outfit, very adaptable to trench warfare at the time of the First World War. At that time, because the jacket had so many pockets in it, it was very good for carrying things because of the density of the material. It would shed most water and mud. It then became a kind of valorous and limited to officers in the First World War. Then by the 1930s, the films in particular had picked up on the idea that it was a kind of espionage foreign correspondent. And Joel McRae, as I recall, in Foreign Correspondent, wears a trench coat, and then Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. That sense of the intrepid individual really being captured wearing a trench coat. So it becomes a real modernized version of a kind of swashbuckler. And I still think that when men wear trench coats today, there's something about that buckling of the belt, there's something about having all of that apparatus that has a real sense of style to it, and that wonderful thing that's often associated with men of style, which is utility, that there's a real reason. It's not a contrivance, but there's a real reason for all that style.
Mm-hmm. Clark Gable is famous for having made the undershirt popular because of And It Happened One Night, when he takes off his shirt. What was the status of the undershirt before that?
Well, actually, when It Happens One Night, he takes off his outer shirt and he's wearing no undershirt. So in fact, what happened was that the undershirt industry was devastated by that. And it was the first time which men in many cases did not wear undershirts.
Oh, I have the story all wrong.
But it's interesting because it's a time at which undershirts became popular for another reason, though, which is then by the 40s, they're being worn as outer shirts, so that men are going back and forth between what they do and do not wear, but largely because of that kind of association. If it is an association with what one wears in It Happened One Night, then you find that you can wear an undershirt again in approximately 1951, I think, in A Streetcar Named Desire, because right. Marlon Brando wears an undershirt, and it's so dramatic, and it's thought to be a kind of ideal of the male.
Here's one of the great questions of menswear in the 20th century. Why is it, you touch on this in Jocks and Nerds, why is it that conservative upper-class men who dress very conservatively through the week, you know, basic gray suit or whatever, on the weekends, we'll sometimes wear lime green pants or red and green plaid pants, really loud pants.
Yes. I think it is, as you say, one of the great questions, and probably inexplicable in a way, except by that wonderful sense of contrast, that these are the men who really have a canon of behavior imposed upon them during the week. They dress in a certain way, and then it is as if they can define bad taste as clearly as they define good taste. It seems to be a kind of extreme. And they wear decoration, those things that we tend not to associate with masculinity, those things we tend not to associate with the upper class. It's almost as if they contrive to be as outrageous as possible. But I wonder if, in not answering the question, but perhaps in providing a thought, simply that it may be that in some ways, because fashion is about utility, but it always is a little bit about a kind of fantasy. Not really about what we are, but about some sense of projection. And there may be some kind of great fantasy that these men are creating for themselves as they go off to the woods and the most bizarre of outfits.
You know, we've talked a little bit about fashion that comes from the top down, from the designers or from Hollywood that filters down to the popular level. But fashion also works the other way. A lot of fashion starts from the street, and then designers pick up on it. Do you see more of that happening now, and where do you trace that back to?
I think very much so. I think probably it's always been there to some degree. When you think about what Chanel did even in the 1920s and 1930s, she was getting some of her ideas from not only from menswear, but from vernacular dress that she was then applying to high style. But certainly you find it in the 1970s and 1980s. It came in part, I think, in a most pronounced way with the phenomenon of jeans. The jeans, which had been identified with the worker, really became something that became designer jeans for a period of time. Interestingly enough, I think now we don't think about designer jeans in that same way in which we did even a decade ago, but that's become a kind of modification. It's a little bit street. Some of the classic styles of jeans have been returned, and many people wear them again, and they are in some competition then with a kind of modified designer jeans. But I think one sees many ways in which designers are taking their ideas from what people wear in the street. When punk was a phenomenon in London, you saw Japanese designers like Rei Kawakubo deriving ideas from punk. Her so-called lace sweater, a torn sweater, really comes out of the torn garments that she had seen in London streets. Jean-Paul Gaultier took extreme ideas to the French couture, really off the London streets and punk. And here in the United States, Stephen Sprouse, to some degree, brought those ideas into 80s design.
Don't you find it somewhat absurd when that happens, when an anti-fashion statement like punk suddenly filters up and gets codified into an expensive fashion statement?
I think it is, yes, it is strange and it's paradoxical, except I have to admit, as someone who personally wouldn't wear true street fashion, and yet I admire it very often, it's as close as I'll get to it. Maybe I need the designer label on the torn sweater in order to wear it.
Well, since you brought up your clothes, let me explain what you're wearing. You're wearing a pinstripe, gray pinstripe suit. Is it double-breasted?
Single-breasted.
And a silk black and white tie?
Yes.
Silk?
Not what a fashion person is supposed to wear, I think.
Fashion people are supposed to dress more flamboyantly?
Well, that would be one's cliche, but I think, ironically, most fashion people dress very conservatively. There are many of the designers who wear almost exactly the same garment day after day, both male and female designers, and who seemingly don't have fashion for themselves, but of course project it for others. I think there's something very reassuring about a kind of uniform. And there's no doubt that I think many people select a garment that really becomes their standard, so we're able to identify them by the clothing at a distance. You see someone coming along and you say, that's the basic silhouette of a friend. You recognize them immediately through the clothing. And there are many people, I think, who do have this funny relationship to fashion, which is to enjoy fashion, but at the same time, also to enjoy a kind of anti-fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were telling me before we went on the air that you wear very similar clothes to work day after day. Do you find a certain reassurance in doing that?
I do. I mean, I think I'm identifiable to people. They know every time they see me I'm going to be wearing a suit during business hours. And I think if one behaved erratically in terms of clothing, it would be difficult to identify someone. I think none of us really behave erratically in terms of clothing. It may be we dress very differently on a Friday going to work than we do the following day when we're going out to the country. But often there is a kind of predictability. And I think the reason for that really is that clothing participates so much in what we are as individuals. We can't change our personalities from one day to another. I would feel uncomfortable sitting with you wearing a purple suit or something outlandish, the way people did, of course, both men and women in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But I never did at that time. Mm-hmm. I certainly would not feel comfortable talking with you in that way.
In the 12 different types that you have listed in your latest book, jocks and nerds and military men and Joe Collegiate, where do you see yourself?
It's interesting. I suppose I should fit into one of the categories, but I have to admit, I think I fit into a number of the categories, as many men do. And I know that for the exhibition itself, we were suddenly looking for an old pair of black denims to dressing a rebel mannequin. And I had those, and an old velvet suit of mine went under the dandy category. So a lot of my old clothes appeared in there under different categories. So maybe, like all men, and I think like all people who are aware of clothing, that really one fits into several roles.
We only have a few seconds left, but I know when I go shopping for clothes, I always walk away feeling really frustrated because the things you want don't fit. And then, especially in women's clothes, there's all these like dumb styles that you really don't want to wear. In the 30 seconds we have left, do you ever get frustrated like that? Or can you avoid that by dressing the same way day after day?
I have to tell you, and I oughtn't tell you, but I really don't buy my own clothing. I go to somebody in a store who buys all my clothing for me, and basically I depend upon someone else, which may show that ultimately, as much as I love fashion, maybe I'm even a little bit intimidated by it too.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for talking with us.